You know, I couldn't say the chapter, but I could explain why bamboo is good for society.
Hey there, this is Stephanie from StephFuccio.com, where we have globally minded podcasts and podcasting services. I am very happy to share with you another episode of Geopath's Language, where we explore our relationship to the languages that touch our lives through conversations with our guests from around the world. In this episode, we are back in Shanghai, China, where I personally lived from 2017 to 2020. This is a conversation that was recorded in November of 2019 and that I shared with you in tiny bits on the NAPOD POMO portion of Geopats. NAPOD POMO is National Podcast Posting Month. NAPOD POMO is an event that happens every November. I initially published this interview in three parts for NAPOD POMO, National Podcast Posting Month, which is the month of November every year, where a bunch of crazy podcasters like myself post an episode every day for a month. It is as stressful and as wonderful as you think. And Ryan and I talked for so long, and there were definitely three distinct sections of the conversation. And so I thought that fit in perfectly with the shorter episodes that I was experimenting with during NAPOD POMO. So I posted it there. But honestly, I think it belongs also on the Geopath's Language podcast. So I've pieced the three parts together and they're here. And I've taken out the NAPOD POMO intro because I'm doing it here just once for you. So there's three parts. In the first part, we talk about Ryan's experience with languages before he started learning Mandarin Chinese and why his experiences in China really, really changed him from a defeated language learner to being the lead interpreter of the Beijing Olympics in 2018. In part two, we dig more into the things he knows about Mandarin Chinese, the things he's learned by digging deep into the language and using the language as much as possible. And we also talk heaps about his views on fluency versus accuracy of a language. Finally, in part three, Brian and I talk about reading a newspaper, typing a message, and what the goal of learning a language really is and how to stay on task to reach your own personal goals. And it is so terribly personal. And I really, really thank Ryan for really opening up about his language experiences, both the failures before he started learning Chinese in China and his successes after that and his continued struggles with the language because I've said it before and I'll say it again, Mandarin Chinese is not an easy language to learn. And there's a lot of various learning curves that you hit along the way. So thank you, Ryan, for being such an open and willing guest to share your language learning story with us. Without further ado, here are the three parts of this conversation. Hey, Ryan, thank you for joining us.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks.
Can you tell our listeners a hair about yourself?
I am a enthusiast for startups and exploring the world and diving into what I don't know. I think is the best way to say it.
Ooh, that is a good way to say it. So curiosity is a strong element
yes.
in what you do. Excellent. Well, that feeds in well to the language story that we're going to dive into today. Why did you come to China? And you don't have to answer that if you want.
No, it's easy. And it's short, unlike other people usually, because I do ask that question a lot and it gets very long. I came to China simply because it was the one place in the world I knew the least about. That's it.
Yeah. So when did you start learning Mandarin Chinese?
I started learning Mandarin Chinese when I came to China for the very first time 15 years ago in 2004. And I discovered something that I could do here that I could never do anywhere else in the world.
Which is?
I could leave the classroom and go learn Chinese on my own in the villages. And that turned everything around for me.
Okay, where were you living?
So I was living in Shanghai. I was very nice to my professors and my teachers. And I would explain to them in the best broken English that I could in Chinese that, you know, I'm going to go learn also on these trips. I would then, because back then there were no smartphones, I'd use my it was a German company, but it was an English-Chinese dictionary. Okay. I would ask someone on the street. I'd say, excuse me, sir, excuse me, ma'am. If you could go on vacation right now, where would you go in China? Mm-hmm. And they'd be like, oh, I'd go to this town.
Right.
And then I'd be, great, thanks. And then I'd go there. That was how I would figure out what I want to go and do. And I'd spend the week there. I'd get back for my class. I hadn't gone over the course material, but I had gotten in trouble. I had gotten in situations. I had had the moments where I needed to learn Chinese or it felt like life or death. And that had prepared me and helped me learn faster and more Chinese than anyone else in my class. You know, I couldn't say the chapter, but I could explain why bamboo is good for society and how it relates to this, because I had been at a tea house the week before with someone explaining to me in Chinese and them expecting me to respond and me shifting through the book, you know, having people stare at me and having to perform life or death at that moment. And that's how I learned in the field. You know, getting into bad situations and really being there, I absorbed so much, and I picked up the language.
Right. Okay, let's slow down and kind of zoom in on those real life situations. You keep saying bad situations. Were you actually in danger?
I was never in danger, okay. But I would say I learned I would put myself in bad situations. Mm-hmm. And I can give an example.
Okay.
And I'll try to make this one short.
No.
So I'm traveling in the south of China, and I'm going through these small towns that are near the Guilin, which are the mountains that are like they stick out like pencils out of the earth, and the mountains and the clouds go around them, and then the rivers between them. They're very Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon-esque. And I am walking through this one town, and I see this beautiful old tea house. It's a two-story Chinese tea house, looks like from the movies. And I'm like, I'm going to go in there and get some tea. And I get in there and I get some tea, and then I just decide, okay, well, what could I do to make today a learning day? So I go into my dictionary and I look up the word mahjong, and I look up the word how to say I want to play mahjong. And I open my book and I say, you know, waiter, please come over here. Waitress comes over and I say, whoa, that's me. And I turn the next page. Want, yao. Turn the next page. And then it's play, so da, and then mahjong. And then I'm like, wo yao da mahjong. And she looks at me like, ni yao da mahjong. And then she starts going, blah. And then everything she says, I go, shi, ha, yes. I basically say in translation, yes, of course, yes. And then she goes, blah. And I'm like, yes, of course. And I have no idea what she's saying.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, wo yao da mahjong. Just over and over again, I want to play mahjong. And because I see kind of like in the corner a mahjong set. And I've never played mahjong in my life. And she's like, blah, 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 blah. She's like, keep on talking to me. Keep on talking to me. I just keep on going, how? Yes. Yes. Of course. Yes. All of a sudden, she walks away and they shut down the entire tea house. They start closing all of the doors around me. Everything starts to close and she starts yelling like that something's going on. And I'm like sitting there like, oh, my God. And all of a sudden, a giant group, two tiers of people just like turn their seats to look at me. And I'm sitting kind of in the middle of the courtyard and I'm like, I don't know what's going on. And they bring out this mahjong set. And then all of a sudden the front doors open up and these old Shanghainese style-esque women with this super tall hair that's colored and jade jewelry, they're the owners of the tea house. And they're the owners of the tea house across. I had just challenged the owners of the tea house to a mahjong competition.
That's awesome.
And I'm in this small town, one of the only foreigners to ever walk through, and I just challenged all of them to mahjong. I don't know any Chinese except for, hi, how are you? What's the weather like? And I'm sitting like, all right, I'm going to learn mahjong, and I'm going to do this. And that's not a life-threatening, but I am feeling
right.
On. I got to perform. This is pressure. What happens is that, you know, I'm getting through with saying, yes, of course, absolutely, all the time to what everyone asks me. And they're like, you know, and then following up with, megoren, American, you know, like, wosha megoren, you know, like just the most simple Chinese trying to say that. And they are just, you know, these titans of mahjong sitting next to me. They're moving. I don't even know how to organize it. I'm just randomly organizing. I'm pulling. They're pulling tiles. I'm pulling tiles. They're lining it up. I line it up. And they're like, someone comes around my corner, like starts helping me move things around and make sure I'm ready, because they realize like one person catches on, like, wait a minute, he doesn't know what's going on.
Then you're dead. Yeah.
And then we start playing and I have a strategy. And I'm like, okay, whatever the person across from me says or does, I will copy. And then after that, whatever the person to my left does or says, I will also copy. And then the person on my right, and I'll just keep on copying in a circle and see how long it takes for them to pick up. And so the person next to me starts and she goes, pung, throw something in there. And I'm like, oh, pung. That's one of the words. And then the person over across from me goes, ch, and grabs one of the tiles. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to say ch. I'm going to grab a tile. And the person over there says, ch, grab the tile. And I go, ch, and I grab a tile. And everyone's like, ooh, he knows how to play. This is it. This guy knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
And then the other person goes, pung, and throws one away. Yeah. And I go, pung. I just grab a random one. I throw a tile. And they're like, oh. And then I start doing this, and I start throwing away all the correct tiles, yeah. all the things that I need to win. Yeah. It's like having an assassin at the table, because I have no idea what I'm screwing everyone else's game. And they suddenly realize that I'm just copying everyone. And the women look at me and start cracking up. Everyone starts just making fun and just laughing so much, because now I'm just throwing things out. I'm saying ch or pung or whatever anyone else is saying. Yeah. Everyone's laughing at me, and then everyone start calling me si chow chow. Yeah. And I'm like, everyone's like, oh, si chow chow. And I'm like, I don't know what that word is. I don't know what's going on. I hear all this stuff. And then, you know, the whole village is basically there. And so now for the next, you know, I lose. I try my best to be generous and say thank you for your time. You know, they buy me an extra cup of tea. Everyone's laughing. Everyone has a good time. I learned something about Mahjong. I learned some more Chinese. And then everyone's yelling at me, hey, Si Chow Chow. Hey, how you doing? Si Chow Chow. I have a nickname now in the whole village. Mm-hmm. And they're all like coming up to me, hanging out with me, saying that. And then later I go home and I figure out Si Chow Chow means roadkill. So my nickname at that village was roadkill, because I got totally killed by all the other Mahjong people. But I learned that. And then I was able to tell that story in Chinese when I came back to my teacher and everything. So I was learning at an accelerated pace, but I wasn't learning the right material. So then I would have to go back and then restudy the books so I could pass the test. But it was so much easier for me, because then I could put it into context. I could put into something else, and all of a sudden everything started clicking. And I'd like to say this happened very quickly, but no, it still was a lot of work.
Yeah.
But I was learning, like you said, for fluency. Mm-hmm. Struggling all my life in language as I was finishing high school, going into college, and then realizing I wanted to go to China before and first. I was actually given exemption from language studies. Mm-hmm. I was proven to struggle so much in languages. They wrote me a special note to make me exempt for my life to study languages as a requirement.
Wait. Are you talking about high school, university?
After high school. So after high school, my professors and my advisors actually came together, because they knew I worked so hard. There was evidence of me working hard. They said, listen, maybe you're just not built for language. And they gave me an exemption. So any school that I went to, I had a written letter saying, hey, this one doesn't need to do language studies.
Whoa.
Yeah, which really just really was sad.
Yeah.
You know, I felt like I really failed out of the game. You know, I failed to a point where it was, okay, so that also kind of drove, like, I'm going to go to China, where the languages is the hardest place in the world as well. I'm going to see what happens. All of my classmates were, even in China, they were acing the test. Mm-hmm. But if you took them out of the classroom in China, they couldn't order food. They couldn't talk to anyone.
Yeah.
And I would sit on the side of the road, have a 10-minute conversation with someone with barely any Chinese.
Yep.
So I was high fluency, but very little ability.
In the middle of these situations, how did you remember what was being said? Was it just the pressure that helped you keep those words?
Yes, pressure helps you keep words, definitely, because it's related to an action. You know, when I was studying something and someone would say, if you were studying Mahjong, and someone would say, oh, chi means to take a pile, to eat, and pung means to throw it away. And, you know, I'd just be like, okay, that's just a point of data. I'm not good at remembering points of data. But if I remember this old lady with very tall red hair looking at me, with way too much lipstick on her mouth, saying ch and throwing it out or grabbing it, and then I'm gonna remember that forever. It's part of a more complex frame of reference for me, which allows me to memorize much better. It instantly is now locked away, and I'm able to recall it more confidently. That confident feeling is my fluency. You know, I've been in those situations. I've gotten in trouble where I had to like talk my way out of stuff in Chinese. I've, you know, done hitchhiking in the mountains of China, where You know, it's like, well, if I'm going to get to this location, I have to convince this person in broken Chinese to put me in the back of their truck, or something bad could happen to me. I don't know. I don't even want to know what's going to happen. So putting myself in bad situations, it was the missing element. In the classroom, I could never do it.
Very few people do. I mean, like, there'll be thematic chapters in a lot of language textbooks. And I'm not just talking about Chinese, just in general. In language textbooks, they'll be like, oh, this is the grocery store chapter. This is the going on vacation chapter, yes. That kind of thing. But you don't actually physically do the things. And I think that's missing for a lot of people. It's definitely missing for me too. And I did a lot of role plays and stuff. I was a teacher. I would make people like get up and go to the other side of a door and like open things and hand things and like make, and the students are like, oh, and I'm like, yeah, but you're going to remember this.
Yes, you are.
Because there's a physical response to the words that you're doing. Mm-hmm. But it's very hard to do that in big classrooms.
Oh, it's very, very, and big classrooms. You're
And with different people at different times, and so much. It's so complex. So you had those circumstances where you're learning the language in context or using them. There's a physicalness to the actions. And then you come back, but you're still taking the classes. How did you combine those two language worlds?
I basically didn't. You know, I would learn my language out of the classroom. Mm-hmm. And then I would come to the classroom to try to share it. You know, and then I would have to, you know, cram a bunch of words and things like that that I was learning. But that was also good because then I was not afraid of talking to the taxi driver. So I had some rules for myself to learn Chinese faster because I knew that, you know, so if it takes on average a normal person to learn Chinese, let's say, I don't know, 20 hours of studying, I had to put in 40. That's just what I figured out for myself. I had to put in double, and I need hacks. I need rules so I can put in double and get more out. So one of them was every single cab driver that I took, I had to talk to them. I had to have a full conversation with them in Chinese, and I had to use the new material that I learned. That was one of my rules. The other rules were everything in my life had to be in Chinese language. My phone, my computer, everything that I interacted with had to be in Chinese. Yes, it's going to take me 30 minutes to figure out where the delete button is, but I'm going to remember it after that 30 minutes.
Right, you are. Because, especially if there's something there waiting for you and you got a notification, you're like, I need to get to, well, not for, if you're looking for the delete button, you want to get rid of something, but still, there's,
but,
you want to move on to the next action.
Everything had to be there.
You struggling with language and people telling you, basically, don't worry about it, you can't do language.
Yes.
And then you come to China and you're doing these workarounds or making these rules and basically building a beautiful language learning structure for yourself.
Yes.
What was the bridge to make you realize you wanted to or could do that?
If you're not interested, if you don't have a passion behind it, you're not going to. For me, I traveled, I went to the countryside, and I saw these hardworking, very kind people that were just so kind. They didn't speak my language at all, and they were helping make sure I was safe. They were helping make sure I was taken care of. They weren't taking advantage of me. The people were so kind and nice to me, like Midwestern nice. You know, not normal nice, like Midwestern, bring you into your house, share some of the fruit from your own, you know, back garden trees, and just make sure you're taken care of, like you feel like you belong. And I didn't speak a word.
Yeah.
I could barely say anything. And that's without, that's knowing that I couldn't give them anything in return. And I wanted to know their story. But what drove me was I decided that I needed to know what their story was. I needed to connect with them. I wanted to understand China. And one of the things about China is that you can't understand China or its culture without its language. They're intuitively tied. Culture and language in China are very, very similar, almost undistinguishable, because it's you know, from the history of the pictograph and how they set it up to what it is today. You know, I was dedicated and I said, no, I'm going to learn Chinese culture. I'm going to learn why this ticks, how this ticks. And I want to know that person's story. And that was my constant driver to do these things, where I didn't have that contextual context before. You know, I was learning because I wanted to get an A. That was never enough for me. And so when I had that drive, I said, I'm doing this because I want to learn about China, because I still know nothing. And that drove me to the next and next and next step, eventually being the head translator for the Beijing Olympics.
The head translator for the Beijing Olympics.
Yeah, there was a few. So I was one of the head translators for the Beijing Olympics for the U.S. team.
How long did that take you?
That took me 8 years.
That seems like a short time.
And I will still say that my Chinese was not good enough. And the thing was, everyone was faster than me. Mm-hmm. You know, people were studying that were just better at languages. And they were in, 3 or 4 years, they were studying Chinese poetry and literature. And I was still just trying to get my HSKs, trying to get everything, but I just never stopped.
Yeah.
I kept on adding rules for myself. So it was, you know, only talk to every person around you. Cab drivers were a rule. And then it was extended to more people talking in Chinese. Have as many Chinese conversations as possible. Everything in my life had to be in Chinese. To only listen to Chinese music, Chinese things. Everything that you enjoy has to now be in Chinese. Then to, okay, you're going to read a Chinese article every day in the newspaper. To now you're going to be doing, you know, little steps to get more and more fluency and more comfortable. And to be honest, people underrate fluency because they can only measure what is tested. Mm-hmm. And so they give weight to that. And I totally get it. And I understand. You give weight to what you can measure. Mm-hmm. You can either, you know, here's the HSK, how high are you going to get? And that's how good you are, because that's a measurable method. But fluency is what you really need. And I've still to this day, I don't know all the words. I'm not the most literate in terms of Chinese, but I am very fluent.
But native speakers of most languages, if not all, don't know all the words of the language. Yeah. Like, we're constantly learning stuff in our own, in a language that we grew up with anyway. Mm-hmm. But and the thing that is least stressed in a lot of language classrooms is the negotiation of language. Even native speaker to native speaker, which, by the way, does not mean skillful. It just means you grew up with that language.
Yes.
You're still navigating back and forth. What do you mean by that? Did you say this or that? Like, there's still a lot of back and forth with one bit of information with communication happening. So that is something that needs to be.
And that fluency of going back and forth, that's the key. Because if you think you're saying something, language is, I mean, it's ethereal. What I think this is and what you think this is. Language is maybe the lowest common denominator of actually what we think this is.
Yeah, exactly. Because language is just one part. Then you've got the thought processes. You've got the past experiences of the person or the motivation of the person.
Yes.
Are they trying to do this
Everything.
Versus that? There's so many things that are not language related with communication. That's so true.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's why I got that one job, because my my whole interview was about fluency, about what I could do, how I could do it, and the proof that I could do these things.
Exactly.
And the constant struggle. Like, I have more struggle stories. Like, I feel like my entire journey on Chinese was Struggle City.
How could it not be? Have you seen them? Of course you have, but listeners, have you seen this language?
But don't give up, because there's so much that you gain from being able to communicate and understand the culture. You know, it's the easiest hack to understand the Chinese culture is to understand the language.
Could you tell us something about the Chinese language that you learned only because you got to a certain point?
Chinese numerology is amazing. The culture and their perspective is very much related to numbers. And they have number games. They have word games with numbers. Things sound like it. Like, that's one of the word games you say. Like, 44 is 40. 44 is 40, but not 44. But not 14. 44. Yeah, it's crazy. And I can slow it down. So you say 四是四是四是不是是四.
That's only 9 words. It seemed like more than 9.
Yeah, and so when you're saying something like that, you know, you're basically just saying numbers, like, you know, the 40 and 44 is not 14 or however you, I forget, actually, I'm probably butchering the thing right now. I think I am. But they love number games, and they love the fact that things sound different. And so, like, in my WeChat, one of my favorite number games is, like, I love the number 1797. 1797 is my favorite number. Only Chinese people will get it. They look at the number, they go, oh, yeah, 1797. That's hilarious. And so if I said that in Chinese, I would say Yao Chi, Yao Chi, Jiu Chi, which sounds like Yao Chi, Jiu Chi, which is a word play on if you're hungry, go ahead and eat. Yao Chi, Jiu Chi.
I gotcha.
So it's if you want to eat, Yao Chi, Jiu Chi, go ahead and eat. And so it's a way of, like, being like, I'm fat, I love food, this is amazing, food's my best friend, or just, like, playing around and having fun with that, or calling yourself a foodie. So 1797 is another way of saying I'm a foodie.
Why do you think numbers? Why are number? Why is it that numbers are so?
Because we don't have, you know, there was something that we never had in, or I never experienced very much of it in America and learning English, and there are so many number games. And there's so many sounds like and play off and idioms and everything about numbers. And then they believe the power of numbers. And so there are, you know, si, four, mm-hmm. sounds like death.
Right.
There's been studies all over China at all the hospitals. Mm-hmm. And on the fourth month, mm-hmm. on the fourth day, at 4 o'clock, mm-hmm. at 4:44, right. there are a disproportionate amount of deaths. People give up. People believe that four is si, and it's the maximum amount of death is that moment. And so there's a bell curve of in China of that, and there's actual power. People give power to these numbers. Whether these numbers have power or not,
sure.
that's up to quantum physics.
Right.
But people believe in it,
yeah.
that's a different thing. And so there's a lot of belief and there's a lot of cultural respect that you can get in China by knowing the numbers, knowing what things mean.
Right.
There's a lot of websites that are like Liu Wo Ba. It's like, let's go buy,
mm-hmm.
you know, like,
mm-hmm.
like you know, or let's go for good luck. It's like things sound similar. They use numbers and all that. So like, yeah, you know, one of the ways to say like good luck is Liu, 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 666, good luck, you know?
Or, okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So they're like eight is good fortune as well.
Right.
And also bye-bye.
Right.
But if I want to say like, go, you can do it. It's Liu, Liu.
Because you said there's a lot of struggle, struggle, struggle. When did you finally feel that you could step back from the struggle and have a little bit of fun with it like that?
I don't know when I could have fun with it, but I remember the moment that I could hear Chinese. It took me 2 years.
Okay.
And I remember I was in a cab, and on the radio was on, and the radio was talking about an event that was happening later that day,
mm-hmm.
That with like a concert or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at my friend, and I was like, oh, there's a concert going on. You know, later this day, they just said on the radio, and then I stopped. It's like,
oh,
I understood the radio.
That's insane.
I heard this. What? It was on the radio, and then it was in my brain. Oh my God. And I freaked out because I'd never had that happen in any language in my life.
Yeah.
And I studied languages for years, for like 15 years, I've been studying languages, and it's never clicked.
Mm-hmm.
The moment that I could just hear the radio and then know what it said. Instead of, you know, a constructed, it has to be someone saying, how are you? Where are you from? Repeating back.
Right.
You know, that, oh man, that was an amazing moment.
So it sounds like the moment where you're just hearing content and you're not realizing what language it is until.
Yes, and then
after.
All of a sudden it just came in. I was like, oh my God, I understand everything.
That's so amazing.
I mean, not everything.
Yeah.
But I actually understand how
yeah.
little I understand.
Yeah.
I got 20% of that. Great. But that's a huge improve.
But you got the meaning of what they were saying
yeah,
in that
yeah,
bit,
yeah.
even if you didn't know every word. That's beautiful.
Yeah. And I will point out that my struggle probably helped me be more confident in my fluency because I never could remember the right words.
Mm-hmm.
And so I never sat on my chair, my high chair of the right words. I'm saying the right thing. Why aren't you understanding me?
Mm-hmm.
I've always had speaking issues. Or not a lisp, but I would say things wrong. And I've gone through, when I was growing up, slow reader, slow one to pick up on a lot of, like, the language expectations. And so always kind of struggling with English. Even to this day, I'm terrible at spelling.
Okay, that makes me wonder what languages were around you. Were there other language distractions?
No, it was basically, I mean, California, Southern California, there's a lot of Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
And so... You pick up a lot of Spanish just by
mm-hmm.
being around there, but it's not as prevalent as maybe living in Europe as would be. And, you know, you'd be learning German and Austin and like French and all these things. But no, it's just, I definitely struggled a lot with languages growing up.
Do you remember when you became aware of it being like obstructing, meaning being
I think, that was my family became aware of it,
mm-hmm.
that it was obstructing before because I was pretty young and I was definitely put into a class, special
mm-hmm.
classes. I used to say the word stupor man instead of super. It was stupor
okay.
man. A lot of things that I couldn't actually say the vowels or the consonants correctly. And I had learned a way to say them that needed to be corrected.
Some of the most successful and intelligent people I've met had language problems as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying.
Wow.
I'm going to include my husband and I in that mix, but also a range of other people that I've heard speak. They've
yes.
all had like language struggles, communication struggles
mm-hmm.
as a kid. And I wonder if that makes us more introspective about how we communicate later on.
Maybe. That's a good point. Growing up, I was told language, it was not something for me. And so as I went past then, you know, I was always
mm-hmm.
told, Ryan, you're going to have difficulties. Ryan, it's going to be harder for you.
Yeah.
And so It's one of those self-fulfilling prophecies,
right,
where it does become harder for you. You were always in your head. So as I was growing up, I studied Latin, mm-hmm, and I studied French. And I would study 5 hours. Mm-hmm. I would study 10 hours, 15 hours. I had tutors, no matter what I would put in terms of effort and work. Mm-hmm. And I would take the practice test, ace them. I'd go in for the real test and get an F every single time. I'd get zeros. I just could not perform. And it might have been the subconscious thinking of, I'm not good at this, I can't do it. But whenever it would come to taking the test, actually doing it, the graded work on any language, I would barely pass or fail.
Did you have any chance to use the language?
No, I've never. In that situation, I was someone who never had to use it, except for testing. So the only engagement that I've ever had with language, yeah, up to high school was, you're learning this to be tested on it.
You know, all too often people assume that language abilities equates with like intelligence, and it's just not true. Learning, mm-hmm, languages and how we learn languages is such a complex issue, complex skill, and really, really different from person to person.
And how we do it's very different.
Very different.
So I developed techniques to go around and explain things so people could easily and hopefully, without a doubt, know what I meant. And so I'll give you an example. When we were at the Olympics, there was a circuit box that power went out and we needed to bring back electricity to the circuit box. So I was looking for a circuit box. I don't know how to say circuit box. It's not a normal thing. I don't know what to do with it. I know now how to say it. But back then, I got to go research. I got to look it up. Nope. All I did was I ran around and I found someone. I said, okay, I'm looking for a box. Mm-hmm. And I was like, it's about this big, great, you know, about the size of your face. And inside of it is electricity. Yeah. And if I punched it, I would die. And they looked at me like, I know what you mean. It's over there.
That's beautiful. So your negotiation, yeah, skills were just,
it was just
right
like,
on.
It was like, listen, it's, yeah, a box. There's power going in and out.
Yeah.
Of this box, still not there, and if I punched it,
yeah,
I'd die.
Right.
And they were like, got it. No, you mean, it's over there. And that was it. And you know, I didn't research, I figured it out later, but that was how I did my fluency.
Right.
My fluency was about describing the situation, what it was, how I would use things, how things would interact with me. Do you get it?
Mm-hmm.
And with only a few data points, mm-hmm, people would totally get it. They'd understand it even better than me using the real word sometimes.
I imagine that would especially go over well in China, where it's such a gigantic country and linguistically it's so diverse, mm-hmm, from region to region, that I imagine they're probably doing that a lot with themselves, with, mm-hmm, the native, quote,
yeah, you're right,
native speakers.
Yeah, right, because there's 255 dialects that are recognized.
So
yeah,
when they're speaking the common language, they're speaking Putonghua to each other, they're probably doing that anyway, because, I mean, you wouldn't necessarily. But even in English, we do that. We're like, oh, what is that thing called? You know, the blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, the thing that I don't know what it's called, but it will kill you if you punch it.
Yeah, I mean, we do that all the time anyway. So to be able to do that in another language, have people understand you,
yeah,
and to keep whatever action is happening happen.
Yes, and then facilitating it, and it's just going forward. And
yeah,
I never got stuck on the word.
Yeah.
I always push through to the meaning. And that was my rule, is that push through to the meaning of what you're trying to say, but not the word.
Yeah.
The first word to come up would usually be a Chinese word. And then I'd be like, oh, it's that thing. I know it in Chinese, but I totally forgot what it is in English. And I used to say that a lot. But now my brains,
yeah,
my Chinese and English brain are working more in unison now.
Because mostly we've been talking about speaking so far. Do you read in Chinese?
I used to read every day when I was trying to do the Chinese newspaper. And my writing is exclusively on a keyboard,
yeah,
or a computer is on my phone. It's all pinyin. I can no longer write calligraphy. It looks like a four-year-old has written. I just don't have the motor skills,
right,
to draw the proper dian and hang,
yeah,
and all that stuff. I can't do,
yeah,
that clean, so it looks like a four-year-old, and I can type as almost as fast as I can do in English in Chinese, because it's just pinyin. It's the romanization.
And that is useful. That is incredibly useful to be able to do. See, I have to ask you a question about newspapers. How difficult was it for you to read newspapers?
Everything was difficult, so it was pretty average in terms of difficult.
Did you find it much more difficult or formal than other things you were reading?
So I found a workaround. I used Yahoo, which has a good Chinese newspapers. And then I had an add-on that if I didn't know a word, I could hover over it, add it to my cards, and then move on.
Your cards, your flashcards.
My flashcards, yeah.
What were you using? What program?
I was using something that was a Japanese company. I can't really remember the name, but and in any language, it really does help. My suggestion is read something that you wouldn't normally read.
Right.
So I read the military section of the newspaper, and that was, everything was new.
Yeah.
Everything, you know, what's a warship? Then all of a sudden you pick up the language, the same stuff over. You realize, because if you jump into a newspaper article with a lot of words that you already know, and then you just feel like it's a normal test.
Right.
Jump into the science section, the philosophy section, and then all of a sudden everything's new.
Right.
And then slowly, and a lot faster than you expect, all of a sudden you start reading. Oh, I know what that is. Oh, I know what that is. And everything starts to make sense.
It sounds like it wasn't so different than other writings that it was.
No, it wasn't that bad. It was just, it was interesting. I had something to talk to my cab drivers about every day because I read the newspaper or one article. It was about 200 to 350 words, and I would time bound it to only be around 30 minutes of my day.
You would read that in 30 minutes and understand it.
It was time bound. I mean, I would force myself to only do 30 minutes. And so it's time bound. So it's like, oh, I didn't finish it this time, but I'm going to get it next time. And so, you know, it's like it's some pressure.
Very clever. So more about the frequency of doing it than
understanding.
It's
not about understanding.
Yeah.
When you're reading a newspaper, it's, again, it's not about understanding.
Yeah.
It's about frequency. It's about showing up to the game, practicing your swing every day. And that's all that it's about. Read Chinese for 30 minutes every day and then walk away.
I fell off of studying, learning, using, thinking about Chinese for like 6 months after my HSK3. Just my brain fell out. Have a new graded reader. The first week I had it, I just listened to chapter one and I was just following along. And every day, even without looking at the words, not reviewing the words that I knew from HSK 1, 2, and 3, every day something in there made more sense just from listening and watching. I'm very visual. So for me to see the characters really helped.
Watch Chinese TV dramas.
It's a little fast for me, to be fair. I have issues with reading in any language. So even English ones, I have to put kind of big and like pause sometimes and rewind.
There is, if you like Netflix, there is a Netflix add-on that will give you the Chinese and the English subtitles together.
No, what I'm saying is the speed of language, reading in any language is slow for me.
Yeah.
So I would have to like slow down the speaking.
But you're picking up other things. So you're not actually trying to get 100% accuracy. You're picking up on how people call each other. You'll pick up on little things that are more like, you know, ever have a friend that learned their English from the TV show Friends?
Yes, yeah.
And the way they speak is just like Ross, you
there
know?
There are so many people that learned off of Friends and Big Bang Theory.
And the way they talk is exactly like that TV show. And you're like, whoa.
I so wish I was that person. It's definitely
work.
In the mix. It does to a degree. Like I said, I'm ridiculously visual. So for me, I need kind of slower, very frequent stuff over and over and over. I feel like I'm getting closer to that. I feel like after a few of these graded readers, I'll be much closer.
Nice.
But right now, I'm just amazed. Just the first week, again, not studying anything, just letting the visual of the characters and hearing it has brought back what I knew, and it has me figuring out, because it's context and it's characters talking to each other, I'm able to work out some of the words that I don't know.
Yes.
And I'm like, that's what I like. I like
that's very cool.
Focusing on reading and there being a reason why the language is being used. I see you've already translated for the Beijing. What's in store for you for the future with Mandarin? Do you have any future language goals?
I would like to, you know, increase my knowledge of Chinese language. I don't consider myself completely fluent. I don't consider myself, you know, even near, like 50% near where I want to be for Chinese. It's more studying. It's getting back to the HSK. There's a lot of things that I lack describing. So if you gave me like a painting and you said, describe this painting in Chinese, I lack a lot of those terms. I need that. And also, you know, in work and in business in China, it's really important to know all the words.
Right.
Related to that, And so studying and researching those kind of words, those kind of conversations that I'll be getting in
gotcha.
In my line of work, and then more words. Like it's just you always need more.
You do.
It's unbelievable. Yeah. You need more context, you need more words, and the studying time. Yeah. So I do it on my phone. I study on my phone almost every day.
Like speaking wise, do you find that most of your day is in English and Chinese, or a balance between the two?
Mine is right now in English, yeah. mostly. In the past, I had a 50-50 split. I know lots of people who have 80% Chinese, and their Chinese is killer. Like, you know, if you can find a job where you need to speak Chinese, do it. Or just go into a small village and donate your time in a place where no one speaks English at all. It's also a good hack. But working and making a living off of speaking Chinese is a fantastic way.
Have you lost any of your language, of your English language, when you learned Mandarin? Is there anything that you were like, I used to know this word, this phrase, or how to say this?
Yeah, definitely. The first word to come up would usually be a Chinese word. Mm-hmm. And then I'd be like, oh, it's that thing. I know it in Chinese, but I totally forgot what it is in English. And I used to say that a lot. But now my Chinese and English brain, are working more in unison now. But yeah, definitely that happens.
I had a previous guest that was asking about Tanya Crossman. She was asking about the emotional language within a language. She started learning Chinese when she was like 12 or 13 and has used it a lot throughout mm-hmm. her life. And so she's like, she wants to hear more about people's, like when they learn to be emotional in language, when they learn to express either happiness or sadness or any sort of emotional struggle. Have you had in whatever you're comfortable sharing?
Oh, no. So for me, that was day one. That was me going into the cities.
Yeah.
And that's what I learned right away. I learned fluency on an emotional level and on a, have to survive level.
But talking about language.
I would have to say thank you.
Yeah.
And, you know, this makes me really happy.
Sure.
And that kind of stuff.
Right.
But like talking emotionally in language in Chinese, I just practice. You know, at this point, I don't think there was outside of really trying to connect and talk to people, because that's my goal. My goal is to connect. I have to emotionally drive
right.
that conversation. And so I was able to pick that up very early. I kind of crossed that bridge first. And then learn the language.
Does English and Chinese feel like different parts of your brain are being worked?
I would say in the beginning, yes.
Yeah.
But now it's not. Because when you're learning a new language, you burn more calories. The biggest muscle in your body is your brain.
Your brain, yeah.
And so you will, you know, you need to feed it.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to burn a lot of calories. Your head's going to hurt. You're going to feel, you can actually get headaches
yeah.
from learning.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it felt like. But then once it starts to get into your type 2 memory set, and then you're pretty much good. Your neurons know what to do after that.
Yeah. So then it just feels like the same.
Yep.
Any other than just keep going and keep doing things, do you have any advice to folks who are just starting or at their first big, do I keep going or do I stop decision point with Mandarin Chinese?
Come to China. Test it out. Do it in the field. So if you think you're going to stop or you think you're going to start, just find a reason, come to China, go to some place where the only thing you can do to survive is talk and speak that language.
Yeah.
And I would say this for any language, anything you want to learn, Hindi, you want to learn French, you know, you want to learn English, like just go to that place mm-hmm. and feel like what it is, because very few people are true polyglots
mm-hmm.
that love the learning of a language, the science of it, the physics of it, the way in which language modifies and grows. Like, that's not me.
Yeah.
But I found my why,
yeah.
and I drove towards it, and my why was bigger than the things that were difficult for me, and I would have never found that unless I would have came.
Do you think people should come when they're an absolute beginner at Chinese, or do you think they should get some basics first and then come?
Absolute beginner.
Absolute beginner.
Yeah, and when you come and you join, don't join level one.
Yeah.
Join level two. Level one is China.
Yeah.
So if, you know, you're here and you're like, I'm just learning Chinese, I'm joining level one, you're wasting your time. Join level two, join level three.
Yeah.
Because you're going to, because just being in China, everyone says, Ni hao, how are you? Mm-hmm. And that's level one.
Yeah.
You're going to spend your entire trip here reinforcing something that is already permeating into you.
Gotcha.
Instead,
yeah.
go for level two. Go for level three. Go higher. Learn level one anywhere else you go.
Yeah.
But in China, your job is to push yourself.
Yeah.
That's it.
Do you think people can learn the language that way if they come here to work and are learning it on the side? Or
yeah, totally. It's okay. Much easier. Absolutely. Yeah. You can learn. It's better to learn Chinese in China.
Yeah.
Because then you have a relationship for it. You understand what things are and why.
Yeah.
And you can play with it.
Final question. Do you have any special phrases that you really like that exist in Chinese that don't exist in English?
Okay, that don't exist in English?
Yeah. Or that just sound better or more concise or that you just like in Chinese.
So the one thing that I like to say a lot in Chinese, we have the phrase, but we never use it. So in America, if there is a sports competition, you know, sport ball, if there's a football or baseball, you know, we have like a cheer.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, go team, go, or hoorah, or, you know, like, or something like that. In China, and usually if it's an international one, we know Americans always know what to say. USA, USA, okay? But that doesn't apply. I wouldn't go to my colleague and say USA, USA. Maybe I should. That's a good idea. But what you do in China is you say 加油, which means add oil. Mm-hmm. Which means go get it, go get it, go get it, you know, like go get it. And in China, you just say 加油 for everything. Say, like, have a good day. 加油. You know? Your team's behind. You want to score? 加油, 加油, 加油. Yeah. You know, China's going for the Olympics? 加油, 加油. You know, you had a bad day. You need to push through? 加油.
Yeah.
And it's this idea of pushing through. And I always say 加油, add oil. Mm-hmm. And I chant it, like, to everyone I know because I love the phrase.
Yeah.
And it's just this great, like, optimistic, fight for yourself, keep on pushing through phrase. And, you know, 加油. Everybody out there, if you're trying to learn Chinese and you want to get into it, just no matter what happens, 加油, 加什么油.
谢谢你 to Ryan for being such a wonderful guest during this conversation. We actually also recorded this in his studio in Shanghai, China. If you are a podcaster in Shanghai, China and need a place to record, I'd be thrilled to connect you to Red Door Studio. So go ahead and message me and I will connect you over to Ryan. This podcast is brought to you by StephFuccio.com, where I offer podcasting services like podcasting workshops, podcast editing, and more all the time. You can find the full show notes, links, etc. to this episode at StephFuccio, StephFuccio.com/Geopats Language/23.